Well, guys, today I have a treat for you. Today we sit down with my good friend Markel as he brings his unique perspective of being a black pastor in predominantly white churches. Guys, when I tell you that I believe this episode is powerful, I believe it. I'm sitting through and listening to it two or three times now myself. I got teary-eyed each time as Markel shares his story because it's that impactful and it's that raw and it's that real. And so I hope you guys walk away with something meaningful from this story today. Hey, if you could do me a favor, if you're watching this on YouTube, you click that like and subscribe button. That would mean the world to me. If you're on iTunes, be sure if you haven't already to click subscribe and rate. And if you're on Spotify, please be sure just to follow us. Other than that, guys, and follow me on Instagram as well. At the story of craft, and let me know what your favorite part about this week's episode is. Other than that, guys, we're going to dive right into this on the Coffee with Craft podcast.
Welcome to Coffee with Craft.
Well, hey, Markel, how you doing today?
I'm doing good, brother. How you doing?
I am doing so well. And you know, Markel, this is a podcast about open and honesty. Mm-hmm. And I want to be honest with my audience. This is the second time we're attempting to record. We had a little computer issue and we're not sure what happened, but we are here and we're excited that we're having this conversation today, aren't we, Markel?
We are here. We are excited. The devil tried to stop us, but he couldn't hold us down, bro.
Oh, man. There's that over-spiritualizing CCU thing.
Well, you know, I got a lot of practice in it.
Oh, man. Markel, we went to college together almost 7 years ago, so I know you super well. But yeah, there are tons of people here at the table who probably don't know you. So, Markel, if you could just give us an introduction to who is Markel, what is his story, what is he doing, I'd super appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first off, thanks for having me on. I'm really excited about the important conversation that we're going to be able to have today. Like you said, my name is Markel. I get the pleasure of being married to a phenomenal young lady named Brittany. Together, we are kind of tag teaming this ministry life. She gets to do ministry through the vocation of mental clinical health. I get to do ministry through the four walls of the local church, and I'm sure we'll explain what all that good jazz means. But we're both from Columbus, Ohio. Met at a little small Bible college in Cincinnati, Ohio, that I'm sure Eric is very familiar with. been married now for we've been married for a little bit of time now. I think 3 years, a little over 3 years. And, we have been living
Brittany's going to listen to this podcast, and yeah, she's probably going to come into the room yelling at you later.
Listen, like, you have no idea how many times I forget, like, which day we got married. Like, our wedding anniversary is our Wi-Fi code. And every single time someone asks for our Wi-Fi password, I'm just like, I got to look at the frame. I got to look at the frame because it's in a date.
Oh, man.
I always forget. But she loves me anyway. So, man, we've been on this journey together in Seattle, Washington over the last 3 years, serving at a local church out there while she's been finishing up her graduate studies. Mm. And just recently, we moved to West Los Angeles. I took an opportunity to serve alongside another local church here to do some pretty awesome things. And she's getting plugged into her career to start working with some kids and adolescents. And, God's been faithful. We're doing some pretty cool things. And, like I said, we're excited to be here.
Man, dude, that is fantastic. You and Brittany are two just amazing people. I love you guys and I love your heart dearly. You've been good friends to me throughout the years, and so I'm super thankful for both of you.
Yeah, well, you're an easy person to be good friends to, I'll say.
Oh, that means the world. But today, Markel, unlike our friendship, we're going to have maybe a difficult conversation or a conversation with some tension in it. Because besides COVID-19, right, there's been a lot of other stuff going on in our world today, especially around the issue of racial reconciliation, racism, racial tension, and things of those natures, with the killing of several black men and women in recent months, mm-hmm, such as George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and things of that nature. And today I wanted to bring you on to bring your unique perspective, mm-hmm, of being a black man working in predominantly white churches, because Markel's story is that he has served predominantly in churches that are a large majority white. Would you say that is correct, Markel?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so kind of the first question today, Markel, that I want you to really use to lead us into this conversation is, what has been your experience as a black pastor or minister within the confines of a church that is largely white?
Yeah. You know, the best way to answer that question is probably it's been interesting. I think that if you are the minority in your at a church staff, I'm speaking at the staff level here, if you're a minority at any church, you're probably going to have an interesting experience. And my experience hasn't been negative, hasn't been all negative. It hasn't been all positive. It's been somewhere in the middle, but it's definitely been interesting. I definitely feel as though that I have learned a lot about myself, about people, about Christianity, about Christ, about race in general, just by serving at these churches. You know, typically, you know, for all of the different staff members that exist at the churches that I serve at, I'm probably the only colored person on staff. And so to give an example, this church that we just came from in Seattle has, you know, a rather large staff, over 100 people on payroll. And as far as full-time ministerial staff goes, I was the only person of color, you know, in a position like that, the only person of color. And we're talking about out of dozens of different individuals. And so when that's the case, when you're kind of, you know, in a monocultured, you know, church, you're going to have some interesting experiences. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you say interesting experiences, and I think that question in and of itself is kind of layered. So I'm wondering if, Markel, you can just give us some background on the type of church you grew up in, because I would dare to say that it was probably different than my church experience.
Sure. Yeah, man. You know, not too uncommon for different Black Americans. You know, I grew up in a situation, you know, kind of in poverty, honestly, and all of the different consequences that poverty kind of brings about. And, you know, everything that I did in my life was, you know, not more than three or four blocks. You know, that, I mean, that was our hood, right? And so in many ways, I went to the church that was in my hood, you know, Calvary in Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, Mount Calvary is a very small church on Mount Vernon Avenue in Columbus, pastored by a phenomenal lead pastor. He's like a father figure to me right now. But this church, man, it was the most formative institution that I can think of in my entire life. You know, my godmother, she kept me in church on a daily basis. And I do mean on a daily basis. And so there were not too many moments that I spent outside of the four walls of that church. And, you know, that church was an extremely small church. It wouldn't even get more than 50 people on Easter. And the reason that's important is because, you know, maybe you're not familiar with kind of the church world, but Easter is like Super Bowl Sunday to Christians. So like every church, you know, tries to go extremely hard to get as many people in the door as they can. It's typically the big one. So if it was 50 people on Easter, you can only imagine what it was like just on a normal Sunday. Man, but I really loved that little small church and still do love that church. And it was a typical Black experience, you know. You know, we had, you know, there's a little bit of a theater, if you will, in the preaching presentation of the gospel from Black preachers. You know, music is a very big thing in the Black church. Expression is really huge. That call and response type of cadence or rhythm, if you will, is a really big thing in the Black church. And so, you know, that was my life. Every single Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, you know, Wednesday for, you know, little youth nights, you know, Friday for revivals, if there was any convocation that came up. And honestly, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. You know, we would grow up calling all of the females in the church sister. So Sister Bradley, Sister Davis, Sister Rogers. You call all the men brothers, you know, Brother Willis, Brother Roger, Brother Croston. Just because I think it was really trying to hit on that idea that, you know, this is family. And I would dare to say that if, you know, you're Black and listening, you probably have had a very similar experience in the church that you grew up in, if you grew up in a predominantly African-American church. So, yeah, no, it was good. I mean, I have really enjoyed it. It inspired me to be the person I am now. It gave me a reason to want to be in ministry, the whole reason in the first place that I even have the desire to go to Bible college or even invest my life into serving a local church is because of the things that I saw, heard, and learned within the four walls of Mount Calvary. So, no, I loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that is your experience growing up. When did you first discover that not all churches look like mine?
Yeah, good question. When did I discover that not all churches look like mine? I think I discovered that probably my freshman year in college. So I did my first year and a half at the University of Akron. And at that point in time, I had an idea that I wanted to do ministry, but I was kind of running away from it for a variety of different reasons. And so I was like, okay, you know what? I'll go get a biology degree or I'll go get my political science degree. University of Akron is a secular college. It'll be great. And, you know, I got up there and, you know, old habits die hard. And it was unnatural for me not to be in a church on a Sunday morning. And so, you know, you go a semester without going to church and it feels like, you know, something's eating you up on the inside. And so I started looking for a church. And my roommate at the time, his parents were going to another church. And, you know, they invited us out to the church. And so we're driving down the highway and the church had been converted out of this old Hoover vacuum factory center. And I'm looking at it for the very first time. And now you got to remember, like, I grew up in a church that didn't have more than 50 people. And now I'm pulled into the parking lot of a church that's literally in an old factory, an assembly factory. Mm. And, you know, we get in there and the service starts and the lights go down and the pre-roll happens and the lights happen and the haze. And, you know, this pastor who really changed my life, literally, gets on stage, you know, in these super tight skinny jeans with holes in them, the most beat up shirt you could possibly imagine, a ton of different rings on his finger, this, you know, cool hip haircut, these tattoos all up and down his arm, which is the complete opposite of what I grew up in. Like,
yeah,
my pastor would wear suits, collars, and like liturgical robes in the pulpit. And, you know, these people are there singing these, you know, these songs I'd never heard of. They have these, you know, 12-piece bands with this kind of like underlying rock theme or this rock sound to it. And for the first time, like, that was honestly the first time I had experienced another church that was not like mine. And the crazy thing about it was, even though it was so different, there was something very similar about it. The way that the people were kind of calling out in worship, the way that the people were responding to the pastor, and the energy and the charisma that the pastor was preaching with, and that same passion and vigor, you know, reminded me a lot of my pastor back in Columbus. And so it was similar in that way. And so, which I thank God for, because, mm-hmm. you know, I think those similarities made it okay for me to keep going back. Because I was just interested enough to keep finding out, like, okay, like, what is this church about? Oh, I didn't know churches even operate like this. And, you know, then I slowly start looking up the type of music they're singing, and I'm like, Hillsong, that must be a little small church somewhere, which it most definitely is not. And, you know, it just exposed me to a completely different world. And it's out of that church that I really launched off into Bible college.
Yeah, that, man, that's some good stuff there. So you launch off into Bible college, you begin to pursue vocational ministry. And mm-hmm. then if I remember correctly, even from your internship perspective and then like kind of your first real church job perspective, mm-hmm. they were predominantly white churches, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, after I graduated, well, I mean, we can even go back before then. While I was still in school, I think it was my senior year, there was this church in, I think, North Cincinnati that really wanted to plan a multi-site at the school that we were going to.
Right.
And someone had the brilliant idea to put me in charge of that multi-site, which was the worst idea, might I add. God, it was so terrible. I did such a bad job.
You mean a 20-year-old being a campus pastor is a bad idea?
Oh, God, it was terrible. But you know what? The pure arrogance and pride of me back then to think like I could do this it's literally comical. But, you know, the mother church, if you will, the head church, you know, was a white church through and through. There were no colored people inside of this church.
And Price Hill, the area we were located in, is a predominantly African-American community.
Full of minorities.
Full of minorities. Absolutely.
So you have this suburban Mason church who you know, with a lot of good intention, a lot of good heart, you know, good leadership, you know, maybe just, you know, directed maybe at the wrong way. You know, they have this idea that they want to plant this church in this very minority driven community. And, you know, for the first time ever, I began to see, like, my background began to clash with the reality that was the white church. And so what I mean by that, and like I said, phenomenal people, they were just ideas or thoughts or themes that, you know, that worked well in the suburban church that I knew for a fact. I didn't have to study this. I didn't have to read this in a textbook. I knew this for a fact because I had lived this my entire life. We're not going to play out well in a church that was built to reach minorities. Mm-hmm. And so I began to see a little bit of the tension that exists between my background and the way things are at that point. You know, then I, you know, got fired. And I graduated and I went to a church down in Charlotte, North Carolina. And this church, you know, huge church, close to 30,000 people. This church is monocultured, if you understand what I'm saying. It's monocultured. So it has a very contemporary culture, even though it is mixed with all different types of people. And so it's a diverse church color-wise, but it's not diverse as far as the culture-wise or the theme-wise. And it was honestly a healthy experience because for the very first time, I was figuring out, okay, look, you know, you're a black kid existing in a narrative that is primarily driven by white people, you know, white men to be exact. You know, you're employed at this white organization. How do you actually make a difference? How do you begin to fit in? How do you begin to assimilate? And all of the different questions and tensions that come around with all of those different things. And I was very grateful because the person that I was serving under at that church understood that and understood the sensitivity of that. And he's a white dude. And he really tried to guide me along through that entire process. And so it was a very healthy learning thing for me. But even then, I saw a lot of how my background was clashing with the quote-unquote white evangelical church. You know, we come back to Cincinnati, we go to a couple of different churches, have a hard time getting adjusted to churches for a variety of different reasons. We go off to Seattle, we serve in this very monocultured and monoracial church. You know, there were, you know, over 100 people on payroll at this church. And out of the, you know, few dozen full-time ministerial staff members, I was the only person of color on staff, period. The only person of color. And we would sit in a weekly basis, you know, in these team meetings where there'd probably be like, you know, 15, 16 people. And we'd be discussing just, you know, the state of the church or the state of politics or whatever was on the agenda that day. And every so often I would look up and look around the table and I would be confronted with the fact that I'm the only brown person, period, sitting at that table. And what an honor it is to be able to represent my culture, my background, my people at that table. But at the same time, wow, like how isolating it was to realize, oh, there's no one that looks like you. There's no one that thinks like you. There's no one that understands your background and that understands your experience. And so when that is what's happening, I can assure you, you know, I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that.
You're good.
When that is happening, when there is only really one or two, you know, colored people sitting at the table in a white evangelical church, you as the white pastor have to be aware of, like, oh no, there are probably some things that are going unsaid here. There are probably some tensions that these people are feeling. There's probably some pressure that they're experiencing. Even if we're not purposely trying to do that, I can assure you that your colored staff member, if they're in that situation, is feeling all of those different things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say the word interesting because it was at that church in that moment that I think that I saw some of the positives to being a Black American working in a church and some of the negatives. So,
yeah. So, man, let me ask the hard question off of that. Yeah. What are some of the negatives?
Good question. whenever you're the only one in a monocultured or monoracial organization, you're going to feel undervalued, you're going to feel underappreciated, and you're not going to feel as though that you actually belong.
Yeah.
Did they purposely make me feel undervalued? Did they purposely make me feel like I didn't belong? I don't think so. I don't think that was the heartbeat behind any of those individuals. But did that make me feel, did I indeed feel that way? Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'll never forget when we first got there, you know, it was literally months. And, you know, we're just ministering to the students and, you know, we get someone that comes up to us just out of the blue. And it's like, you know, aren't you a Muslim? You know, they know nothing about my background. They know nothing about my history. The first thing that they associate, you know, me with is like being, you know, some radical Muslim, you know, on an agenda. And I'm like, yes, I am a Muslim who got a Bible degree and who works inside of a church. Wow. I'm such a secret operative. I can only imagine what my mission is here. like literally ridiculous. And then there were even more extreme situations of like, you know, the pastor at the time, you know, phenomenal pastor, gifted communicator, one of the best verse by verse expository preachers I've ever heard in my entire life. You know, he set the standard of kind of what like teaching and preaching was in the church, and I heavily enjoyed him. And every time I would get ready to preach, obviously growing up in a different church background, I learned how to preach completely differently. And yeah. So every time I would preach like that, you know, of course you get the, you know, the positive responses from the people that you were preaching to, but I'll never forget that my supervisor, we had to have more than 4 or 5 conversations. And this is the truth. You know, comes to me and says like, hey, I think you're preaching unbiblically and I want you to preach more like this and like that. Now, do I think that he was trying to tell me that I needed to bury my culture, or I need to bury my background, I need to bury my DNA or how I was brought up? Absolutely not. I don't think that was his conscious thought. Is that the way it was taken? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know.
And so that's so fascinating. He told you your preaching style was unbiblical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He's a good man. Like I said, I don't know if he recognizes how that made me feel. You have to understand, like,
yeah,
already feeling alone and isolated and kind of like a, you know, like the sore thumb in a community, those type of comments, they just compound on top of everything else. And it really, really makes you feel alone and isolated. And so what I'm thinking in that moment, you know, in his mind, what he's probably thinking is like, okay, you know what? I'm giving him some helpful preaching advice to be successful here at the church. And in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, you're trying to whitewash what I'm doing so that I can assimilate better to your monoculture. And here goes the most frustrating part of all of that, Eric. It's that I sat there, I listened to that, I felt hurt, I felt angry, I felt disgusted, went home, told my wife, blah, blah, blah. I came back the next day and I did my best to assimilate.
Yeah.
I did my very best to whitewash what I was doing. You know, and that wasn't just for preaching. That went for everything.
So I'm always fascinated by the answer to this next question. Mm-hmm. So you say you whitewashed everything, like your entire style of ministry and things of that nature moving forward from that experience. Were you afraid of having the tough conversation of how your supervisor made you feel with him, or were you afraid? What were your feelings or emotions, and why'd you choose to assimilate versus maybe fighting back or leaning into conversation?
Yeah, man. You know, bro, my wife was in grad school.
Yeah.
I just moved us across the country.
Mm.
On, you know, literally nothing. More than just kind of a hope and a dream. And, you know, this is gonna sound terrible, but, you know, what I thought was the biggest priority in that season, or at least at that moment, was making sure that my family was provided for.
Yeah.
And so there's a sense of, you know, you don't want to rock the boat.
I get that.
If you don't have to. And here's the issue. Please hear me out for every single black person that's listening. I know there are hundreds, thousands, millions of Black individuals that understand exactly what I just said. And you have to understand that you're not wrong for feeling that way. You're not wrong for understanding you have priorities. You're not wrong for thinking about your responsibilities. But at the same time, it's not right that you were made to feel that way. And that's something that took me a long time to learn, Eric, is that I wasn't wrong for feeling that I only needed to shut my mouth just so I can continue to collect the paycheck so that we could continue to live and go on. And there were other things behind it too. Like, you know, I desperately loved the students that we were working with, and I wanted to stay around, obviously, to help them and those different things. But yeah, man, of course I was afraid to speak up and say something. You know, here's the danger of a monocultured church. A monocultured church says our way is the best way, and anything that disrupts our way is bad. And so we're going to demonize what's bad. We're going to weaponize the fact that you defied us, and we're going to turn the narrative. Now, that can happen for an organization that intends to be malicious, and that happens to organizations that don't have any intention to be malicious. It just happens. And so, you know, I'm in this completely white church with this white staff, and at this point, too many times, over and over, I have seen certain things just kind of get, you know, not dealt with in the right way. And so, you know, I didn't want to be in the principal's office, if you will, getting in trouble. You know, I wanted to keep my job. I wanted people to see that I was a team player. Wanted people to see that I could get the job done. I wanted people to see that I wasn't a complainer. You know, I wanted people to see that, you know, oh, if I need to count on someone, you can count on Markel. I wanted to be that person. And I think when you're looking for the approval of supervisors and executive pastors and, you know, the people around you, and they're all kind of think one way and look one way, you kind of feel a little bit of ashamed to be Black, if I'm being honest. Because, you know, you feel as though that it's a handicap in this situation. And at the same time, you're just like, well, there's nothing I can do about that. I just am who I am. And so if I wasn't born white, then I'll just make all of my intentions white. I'll make all of my actions white. And that's very difficult. And I greatly regret the fact that I did that, because it's not right. It's not right even in the slightest.
Yeah. Well, I want to first thank you for being vulnerable in that moment, because I know that was a hard question to answer. But I also know, like, even from my perspective, that when I feel as though someone attacks me, right, for the way I look or for how I come across at times, and I've experienced those things within a church setting and have been hurt on staff at a church. I know I've told you some of my story and things of that nature. But I always felt as though I had a voice to speak back and that I wasn't afraid to speak back. Yeah. And so the reason I asked that question was I was genuinely curious what was underneath the root of that. And of course, you know, I think there's that, like, you were super spot on, I guess, with, like, the whole idea of, like, you have a family to provide for, you just moved to Seattle, why would you want to cause more tension, things of that nature. I get all that. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing too that, like, I took for granted in that moment is that everybody has a voice to speak up. Mm-hmm. When in reality, people's voices have been taken away from them so often. Mm-hmm. And people who are different than me have had their voice taken away so often that now they feel like they can't speak up. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I definitely feel like that's true. I think there's categories to it. I think that there are people that, you know, are in organizations that genuinely cannot speak up. And then I think there are organizations, and I would say that, at least in my experience, I can't speak on behalf of the entire church at Global.
Absolutely.
But in my experience, I think the churches fall into the category of, they're not telling you you can't speak up, but they're not helping you amplify your voice. And they aren't doing that, in my mind, out of a position of bad heart posture. They're doing it out of a position of ignorance. And not knowing, and out of a position, once again, of being so afraid that their culture will get changed, that their overprotection of that culture makes them mute you in different ways that they may not necessarily be realizing it.
Yeah. And I think, I wonder, and this is probably a whole nother episode for a podcast, but I wonder if the heartbeat of a church and the heartbeat and the value system of a church has become so inflated with culture that people have misrepresented the two. That culture is what we look like and how we express our heartbeat and values, but we've taken heartbeats and values and made those culture instead. And so anything that threatens culture, we think is threatening our heartbeat and value, when in actuality, it's really only changing maybe our method and expression of our heartbeat and values.
Right.
If that makes sense.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's important for any white leader to hear. It's, you know, for that colored person that's on your staff team, they're not there to do your church harm, or else they wouldn't be there. They're there to push forward the mission, to push forward the vision, if it is clearly articulated. They're there to be a part of the family. They're there to help. You know, I remember when Brittany and I, we arrived in that parking lot, and my eyes were just full of hope and wonder, because all I wanted to do was come there and serve and help and be a blessing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think if you serve in ministry, there are going to be a lot of different things that dim that light, that try to throw out that passion. I'm not a big believer in passion anyway. The senior pastor I served under in Charlotte, North Carolina, would do these teachings, incredible gifted pastor, and he would always say things like, you know, passion is not a feeling. Passion is shown through consistency. And so I think there are a lot of different things in ministry that are going to try to push you off that road of consistency. But the biggest thing that kind of, you know, took that passion, if you will, or that consistency out of my eyes was the fact of like, oh, I genuinely feel alone in this. This is a 2,000 person church, like I said, over 100 people on payroll, dozens of people are always in the building, in their offices, and yet you feel very alone in the journey that you're dealing with. And how do you speak up about it? Will people respond well? I don't know. I'm too afraid to speak up about it. But I don't think any colored person that comes to the church is there to ruin the church. I think it's okay to have people that come and change the way that you express the things that you care about. That's not an assault on values. That's not an assault even on your culture. If anything, it's an enhancement if you can be disciplined enough to see that.
Yeah, man, that is good stuff. So, hey, I want to switch the narrative a little bit, because I feel like I love your story and I would hate it if we didn't learn from it. So my next question is simply this: what can white leaders within churches do, both from a senior pastor level down to the lowest of the youth minister level, right? What can white church leaders do to better promote true diversity and inclusion within our ministries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great question. I say that leaders would first need to probably educate themselves on the issues. I think any leader that blindly believes that their staff member, you know, their Black, Latino, XYZ staff member is just going to kind of come in, fit into our all white church, and it's just going to be all rainbows and roses. I think that's pretty ignorant. I think that's pretty foolish. I understand why you would think that. Everyone thinks that their thing is like the best, right? And that there's no issues there. But, you know, you have to look at the role that the evangelical church has played in pushing slavery and Jim Crow. There's a phenomenal book that I would recommend to everybody called The Color of Compromise. And it looks at just that. It looks at how the white evangelical church has played a massive role in the deconstruction of minority communities for decades. And so I don't think those things just go away overnight. I don't think that people forget about those things overnight. I don't think that those policies, those principles, those institutions, they just kind of vanish overnight. You know, if you're a white leader, you need to be on high alert, understanding that one of the ways that the enemy is going to come in to try to disrupt your staff team is by letting that young or old, you know, black person on your team feel isolated, feel like they have nothing to contribute, feel like they have nothing to add. And so if you're a white leader, number one, I would say educate yourself on the fact that, you know, try do your best to educate yourself on the plight of that minority. I think that's a good first start. The second thing I would say is you got to be intentional. And here goes the thing. Intentionality is really hard. It's really difficult. That means coming out of your office, going to their office, taking them out to lunch, taking them to coffee, asking them how they're doing, asking hard questions. Hey, you know, we said this from the pulpit. Hey, I'm thinking about saying this from the pulpit. How does that even register with you as a human being? Not as a representative of the black community, right? But you as a human being who is black, you know, how does that register? Or, you know, I heard that this was coming up in staff meeting or, you know, it's about just being aware of the little sensitivities that can come to destroy something. And so I'll give a great example. I remember one time we were sitting in a staff meeting, and for some reason, the conversation of immigration came up, and how do we as the church deal with immigrants? And the conversation in general is not a bad conversation to have. It may be even a good conversation to have if you're genuinely interested in how do you begin to care for people who don't have very much, who have come to this country and have left behind a lot of different things. But the conversation definitely turned political. And I'm just sitting there and I look across at one of my good friends and he just looks across at me and we're just kind of thinking the same thing. And I'm like, isn't it like so funny that the people that are trying to make decisions on behalf of these people are old white men? And so even as a leader, if you're sitting in that environment, even just having the sensitivity to say, you know what? This conversation, I'm sure, is very awkward for them to sit through. I'm going to check on them a little bit later to see how those things landed. Or, hey, I want to intentionally call out Sean. Or I want to intentionally call out Jaron. And I want to ask him, what does he think? Since he's the only one that probably has any experience with this, what does he think about this? So I would say educate yourself. Intentionality is very important, even though it's hard. And then, you know, honestly, it's not enough to have, if your church has the resources, it's not enough to have a black janitor or an Hispanic maintenance team member. It's, okay, I want to be intentional about diversifying my junior leadership team, my freshman leadership team, and my senior leadership team. I don't want to just have minorities that are just playing the associate youth pastor role. No. I want a minority eventually to be able to play the youth pastor role if they're the fit for it, right? I want a minority to come in and be on our executive team to change up how we're thinking about things. Like, I want a minority that could be our executive pastor. You know, I want a minority that's sitting on our eldership team. I need someone who just thinks differently and has a different background to be with us just so that we can get a full understanding of the picture. And I mean, I think that probably follows under intentionality.
Yeah. Man, that's good stuff. Are you there?
Oh, yeah. I was just thinking about, I'm trying to think because, like, I'm going to give it, a quick shout out here. To two people. Dr. Steve Carr, Cincinnati, you know, a really great man. You know, as white can be. I tell you, I've never seen another pasty brother. He's going to hate that I said that. But he's been such
a good, great dude.
He's a phenomenal dude. He's been such a phenomenal mentor. And here's what I love about him. He saw me as the black kid on campus. And at CCU, when I first got to CCU, there were not many black kids on campus.
Yeah.
Like, at all. He saw me as the black kid on campus. He's like, hey, you know what? I want to invest in you. I want to know you. I want to get to know your story, and then I want to help advance you for no other reason other than the fact that I just want you to win. And I think that intentionality, I bet, was just so difficult, especially the days that I was interning for him and I was just slacking off and just doing all the wrong things. And he's just like, it doesn't matter. I still want to pour into you. I want to advance you. You know, I give him a lot of props because you know, I think he set the model for me of what I want to do for people that don't look like me. And then, you know, there's a gentleman, you know, out of New England, Daniel King. He serves as, you know, the head of operations for this really thriving church out there. And I've never met the guy face to face. And I think he's in New Hampshire. And, you know, once again, as white as you can be. And even today, right before we even started recording this, you know, he's texting me saying like, hey, man, how are you doing? Like, how are you doing? Not how's the church doing, not how's the ministry doing, but how are you doing as an individual?
Yeah.
That type of intentionality, that type of like, hey, I'm genuinely interested in how you're doing as a human being and how you're going through things and how you're overcoming and how you're learning.
Mm.
I think that is the roadmap that we could probably all kind of learn from.
Boom. Man, that is such good and incredible stuff. Because I think you're so right that for us to move forward, we have to have relationships with one another. You know, we have to be willing to sit and listen and learn from one another. And we have to be willing to be intentional with one another and put in the hard work of recognizing that people have different perspectives and life circumstances than me. And thus I need to invite them to my table where they can openly speak, not invite them to my table to just hear from me and to follow me, but invite them to my table where they might even be able to lead me.
Yeah.
Like that is huge, man. Such good stuff there. Hey, Markel, to close out our conversation today, what's one thing that you hope the listener walks away with?
Well, if you're a white listener, I would say that you have an active part in ensuring that your brothers and sisters who look differently than you belong. It's not a passive thing. And some days it's just going to be hard for them to feel that way. And you know, it may seem unfair to you, you know, X, Y, Z, whatever your thought is, you know, you have an active part in making them feel like they belong in that circle.
Yeah.
And it's going to take work. You got to understand that. It took a lot of work to cause the division in the first place. It's going to take even more work to build the bridge. But if you're a black listener, you got to understand, look, you know, you were uniquely made. You were phenomenally made. You're wonderfully made. You are exactly who you need to be. And if an organization doesn't appreciate you for being the person that you need to be, you know, I pray that the Holy Spirit would open up doors for you to exit out of that organization into another organization that will treat you well. But, you know, God has not called you in this time to be silent. He has not called you in this time to you know, shut your mouth or just keep your ideas to yourself or just to sit in the back of the room. No, he's called you to be in the front. He's called you to speak up. He's called you to be loud. He's called you to be a person of character. He's everything that went into your development. God didn't just, you know, say like, oops, I hate the fact that was there. No, he's using it all together to do something great. And so I just be proud of the fact that you are who you are. And, you know, don't let any organization, don't let any boss, don't let any person, you know, shut your mouth. You know, I know it's pretty, I know what you're feeling when you're like looking at the news every single day and you're seeing, you know, an innocent dude being killed. And I know exactly what you are feeling when the person who was killed then becomes vilified in the news media. Well, you know, they're a criminal, blah, blah, blah. And there's like, are you serious here? We're trying to, you know, criminalize the person who ended up dead. I know exactly what you're feeling. I know what you're feeling when, you know, you're out on those streets protesting. I know what you're feeling when you're trying to have these conversations with your white friends or white individuals. Keep doing all of those things. Keep moving forward. Keep being uniquely yourself. It's a good thing. And I guess I do have a third group of people that I want to talk to. And that's the people that have probably been out on the streets protesting, whether you're black or white. You know, if you want to see actual change begin to happen in your community. You have to understand that politics is a part of that change. And every single major legislation that has really moved the needle for people groups in this country has never started at the federal level. It has always started at the state and the local level. Mm-hmm. And so thank God you're out protesting, but make sure you walk to the ballot in November. And I'm not just talking about voting for the president, but I'm talking about you got to vote for the people that are going inside your state houses. You got to vote for the people that are going inside your city halls. You got to vote for the city comptroller. You got to vote for, in every position that is up for election, you have to go out and vote for that, because that is where the change happens at a state and a local level. So continue to protest, but also make sure you go to the ballot to vote in November.
And if there's a local position that you think there's not a good candidate for, maybe you need to run for it.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, seriously. Absolutely. That dude, such good stuff there. I appreciate it. Oh, so much. So, Markel, I know we have taken up a large part of your evening today, but I just wanted to say thank you so much for being open and vulnerable in this conversation with us today. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your heart and sharing what you're about.
No, thank you, man. I thank you for having this conversation. And I know that, you know, there's a lot more conversation to be had and there's deeper things to dive into. But you're doing good work, my man.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. And thank you for pulling up a chair and having a seat with us today on the Coffee with Kraft podcast. I appreciate you a whole heck of a bunch. I will see you guys next week.